This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In 2012, The New York Times Magazine published a detailed story about the sexual abuse of students at the Horace Mann School, an upscale private college preparatory school in the Bronx. As you might expect, the story got a lot of attention, but has prompted very little change.
Two that are living have already admitted to that they did this. But again, because of the statute of limitations, nothing is going to happen to them.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of that article, who's expanded the story into a new book called Great is the Truth. We'll also hear about a new law being touted by two elected officials from New York State and spend an academic minute finding out how your brain does what it does. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Horace Mann School has been operating in New York City since 1887. It's not easy for a student to get in. You've got to have good grades, pass a personal interview, and score high on an entrance exam. You also need some cash. It's one of the most expensive private schools in New York, with tuition at over $40,000 a year. And it was the scene of repeated allegations of sexual abuse of students for years. Amos Camille wrote about these allegations in a cover story for the New York Times Magazine back in 2012. He's recently expanded the story in the new book, Great is the Truth: Secrecy, Scandal, and the Quest for Justice at the Horace Mann School. Amos Camille graduated from Horace Mann back in 1982. I asked him what drove him to write this story.
I was a student at Horace Mann. I was a middle-class kid that got to, the keys to the kingdom, if you will. And early on, I was led around by a friend of mine. He said, we want to avoid these teachers. And I said, what, like hard graders? He said, no, they're pervs. Stay away from this one. Stay away from that one. And, it sort of stayed in that teenage sort of cluelessness, if you will, until I was about 27. I went camping with four buddies, so there was five of us. And one of the guys I call Andrew in the book, he told us how he was abused by a football coach by the name of Mark Wright. And I sat on that. We all went on with our lives. We had families. And when the Sandusky thing happened at Penn State, I called up Andrew and I said, listen, how are you doing? And he said, I'm not doing too well. I wish somebody would write about it. And that's what ended up being the front page story of the New York Times Magazine called Prep School Predators.
And that article got tremendous reaction, didn't it?
Tremendous reaction. At that point, I talked about three predators. And what happened after the publication was astounding. Thousands of comments on New York Times. They had to shut down the comment section. Independent groups sprouted on Facebook. Over 2,500 Horace Manners got on this site called Processing Horace Mann, a Facebook page, just talking about all aspects of the school. And what happened was they would start to come out more and more accusations. And we are credibly at this point up to 22 different predators at Horace Mann, which is a tiny school. And year after year, voted one of the best schools in the country by Forbes.
Let me go back just a second. Were you working at the New York Times at the time?
No, I was a freelancer. I came to them with the story. They took my story, and then I investigated the piece, and it was checked and fact-checked and refact-checked, and we were making some pretty big claims. So, no, I was a freelancer.
I was going to say, with a story like that, it must have been something to actually get that in.
It was, and at first I think that they knew that there had always been rumblings about weirdness at Horace Mann, and my editor, a woman by the name of Ariel Kaminer, had gone to Horace Mann 5 years after me, so she knew all the teachers. She walked it in the door and said, this guy is credible, this is a credible story, there's something here, and she really shepherded that relationship. So it was a bit of right place at the right time.
And from the reaction you got when you first got to the school, it didn't seem like this was much of a secret. It was pretty open among the students.
Well, yeah, in the way that students talk, it was, but I don't think that anyone knew. If you've been abused, as a 15-year-old, a boy or a girl, it's not something you're running around telling other people. So that, at best, you're sort of, lending to other rumors about stay away from that teacher, but in a vague sense. But nobody, certainly the students, we thought it was strange behavior. And I was laboring under the notion that a lot of the teachers knew. I've had to soften that position. Certainly some knew and some tried to block knowledge from coming out into the world. But many were pretty naive or young, and others just didn't want to know. They didn't want to rock the boat. They had kids at the school. It's a hard thing to accuse somebody of. So there's a wide range of knowing.
And that article came out when? That was 2012?
Yeah, June of 2012. And really what prompted me to write the book, Great is the Truth, which, by the way, is the Horace Mann motto, Great is the Truth, is the fact that the truth had taken so long to come out. It had been suppressed. And what we thought we knew wasn't even 1% of what we thought we might know. The truth was so much deeper and uglier, quite frankly.
This was a private school. It was not a public school. And it really wasn't even a religious school. Did that make any of a difference, do you think?
Well, it's funny. There's a loophole in the statute of limitations laws and the reporting laws in New York that actually make kids in public schools safer than kids in private schools right now. Because as a private school administrator and teacher, you're only required to report if it's a parent or a guardian that's sexually abusing a kid, not a fellow teacher. It's a huge loophole in the law. So in some strange way, public school kids are actually a little bit better off in that regard than people are paying over $40,000 a year to send their kids to places like Horace Mann.
Well, once this story came out, I'm sure things at Horace Mann kind of changed a bit. What happened? What's been the reaction to all this?
Well, on the one hand, it changed for the current parents and students because they became more vigilant, in a sense. And the last recorded instance of abuse was in 1996. So while the abuse is no longer going on, the cover-up still continues. And there was an independent investigation funded by the alumni that the school itself refused to cooperate with. And they entered into a mediation process with 32 of the survivors, but they treated it less from a healing-centered standpoint and more like a mergers and acquisition negotiation with people, as if the abuse hadn't been done under the auspices of the institution they today represent, and the same glorious tradition which they raise a lot of money on. So they really tried to divide the things that happened in the past, as they would say, with the school we need to run today, and the current parents and students. And that has enraged many, many of the alumni, hundreds if not thousands, who won't ever write a check to Horace Mann again until they make this whole.
Have any charges been brought against anybody?
No. No charges have been brought against any of the perpetrators because New York has probably one of the worst statute of limitations laws when it comes to sexual abuse, shares that distinction with Mississippi and Alabama. You have in New York State until the age of 23 to come forward, and most people don't come forward, if at all, until 40s or 50s. The average age is 42 before anyone will speak about the abuse that happened to them as a kid. And so to expect a 17-year-old not only to go up against his accuser and abuser, but to also take on the institution, or even a 23-year-old, is it's a little absurd. And it's well past the time that somebody called it a Neanderthal law gets changed.
There are so many people you talk about who have been so affected in this book. Talk about Ben Balter and his situation with him and his mother.
Sure. Dr. Kathy Howard was a very popular science teacher. She had two sons at the school, Ben and Charles. And her colleague, Johanna Somari, on the faculty, took an interest in her son, Ben. He was teaching him piano. And they went away to Europe, and Ben came back a very different person. And he actually came forward and wrote a letter in the early 90s to the school that Somari had been abusing him and was being inappropriate. And the school had the letter on file, and they denied it, and they wouldn't ever do anything. When Kathy Howard herself confronted Somari, he said, well, that's, about kissing her son, with his tongue. He said, well, that's how we Swiss kiss. And when Kathy Howard brought it to the authorities at the time, they basically told her unless she had videotape of it, needed to stay between them, and she didn't have a case. So she was told to go away. Sadly, Ben Balter went on to commit suicide. And before that, he had lived sort of a meandering life. A very, very sad case. And worse than that, Somari went on to abuse others after Ben had blown the whistle on him. And was actually, allowed to retire with honors from Horace Mann in the 2000s.
Are any of these teachers still with the school?
No. Many of the teachers are dead. Many are retired at this point. They are alive, some of them. Two that are living have already admitted to that they did this. But again, because of the statute of limitations, nothing is going to happen to them. There are administrators still associated with the school and board members still associated with the school that knew and made it go away back then. And they're still very much around.
Are there still people fighting for either settlements or legal action?
Well, Horace Mann, as I said, entered into mediation with 32 different survivors. Many of them settled for pennies on the dollar because they didn't. Horace Mann took the position because of the statute of limitations. They didn't have to pay them anything. So some went away with a couple of $1,000, but few walked away from the proceedings. One person who was also abused in New Jersey went over to that state and for the same exact crime received millions of dollars. A couple of people, one person in particular, walked away from the whole mediation process and was waiting for the Child Victims Act to pass before going back and actually getting some real money from the school. So, and we also know that 32 survivors have come forward. I know personally of about 7 or 8 other survivors who have not come forward yet, and we estimate there's probably about double that amount. So there's probably, you know, about 30 people in the waiting to see if the law ever changes.
Still to come, our conversation with Amos Camille continues with a look at the attempts to change the law in New York State and their lack of progress. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Amos Camille, author of the new book, Great is the Truth, Secrecy, Scandal, and the Quest for Justice at the Horace Mann School. Well, you spoke about the New York Child Victim Act. Assemblywoman Margaret Markey has that in the legislature. What's the progress on that now?
No, not much progress at all. I think we're at a moment in time where it actually could happen, but it's never made it to the Senate, to the floor. It has overwhelming support, both, people, when you ask them, they're polled. They want their politicians to be on the side of the victims. But there are pretty strong lobbies, particularly the Catholic lobby in the state of New York, that doesn't want this bill to be passed. They're spending a lot of money and, walking up and down the corridors of Albany, keeping things locked up. But the bill could easily pass if somebody, had the wherewithal, like the governor, to bring it to the floor and make it pass. It's time that New York joins the rest of the country in changing the laws. There's no statute of limitations on murder, and so this needs to change.
And is that what this law would do? It would change the statute of limitations, or would it do anything else?
Yeah, it would change. What the Markey bill essentially is saying is right now they would raise the age that you could have to come forward from 23 to 28. No one really has a problem with that. The issue that they're fighting is it would put in a one-year window where anyone could go back and make a claim against their abuser. They estimate that tens of thousands of people would come forward, and a lot of money would exchange hands, and that's what the people who oppose this bill, particularly the Catholic Church, is fighting.
Do you think that bill, that law, if it were passed, would be a good legacy for this story?
I think it would be the perfect ending to this story. It was really not why I began it, but as I got to know many of the victims and the lifelong, the decades of suffering that they've endured, whether it be drug addiction or shattered lives through divorce or overeating or you name it, alcoholism, some measure, not that any money can ever replace those lost years, but some measure of the notion that this happened, that the school and the state will help me get on with my life is what's necessary. I would be a perfect ending to this whole sad affair.
Talk about, if you can, the Hilltop Cares group. What is that all about?
There's a group, two groups that started out of Horace Mann. One is Hilltop Cares, and they are a group of alumni that want to give money to the survivors for therapy. Another group called the Horace Mann Action Coalition, they basically funded an independent investigation by Judge Leslie Crocker Snyder to find out what really happened at Horace Mann. And they put out their finding in something in a document called Making Schools Safe. And it's an extraordinary reaction from a student body, from people who are not abused mostly, to come to their fellow alumni's side and basically say, we want to know what happened to you. And even if the school's not going to pay for it, and Horace Mann's not even going to cooperate with the independent investigation, we're going to make your stories known so that it won't happen in other places as well.
Well, one more. I guess I'll ask you about the Law and Order episode. Was that about Horace Mann?
It appears to be ripped from my headline. The school was, they talked about, a several hundred acre campus up in Riverdale, and it was called Manor Hill, M-H, as opposed to H-M. And there were many, many similarities to it, the piece that I had written for the Times. So, yes, so many people think so.
You haven't seen a check from that, have you?
No, not yet. I check my mailbox every day.
And again, the name of Amos Camille's new book is Great is the Truth, Secrecy, Scandal, and the Quest for Justice at the Horace Mann School. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Congressman Paul Tonko, two New York State Democrats, recently went to Albany to push legislation they say addresses a skills gap and enhances job training. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports.
In September, U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and three colleagues announced an updated Apprenticeship and Jobs Training Act. They say the bill would help the next generation of American workers develop skills to secure well-paying, high-demand jobs. The update of the April measure came after President Obama announced his administration is putting $175 million toward apprenticeship programs across the country. Gillibrand, along with Congressman Paul Tonko, State Senator Neil Breslin, and Assemblywoman Pat Fahey, toured MCD Metals LLC at Albany's corporate circle in an effort to push the bill.
Many communities across our state, including the Capital Region, are still trying hard to rebuild from the recession and trying to make sure our economy is competitive for the 21st century.
The bipartisan bill would create a $5,000 credit for employers that use apprenticeship programs in professions including healthcare, manufacturing, and technology. Tonko says there is a vibrancy to the manufacturing sector.
It is a changed area of activity. It is cutting edge. And for us to be able to compete in a global marketplace, we need to have investments made across all the infrastructure, from capital to physical to human infrastructure. The worker training is essential.
Jeff Stark is president of the Greater Capital Region Building and Construction Trades Council, which has its own apprenticeship program.
This type of bill is very important to manufacturing, but also our multi-employer plans, because this will hopefully position people in manufacturing for our future. And it's no secret that there's been a big loss in manufacturing, and it is on the comeback. And these are the kind of tax credits that we can use to be built in America again. And not only just union, but, made in America.
Gillibrand says the legislation will help the U.S. to remain competitive with an innovative workforce.
90% of men and women who have completed an apprenticeship program are employed. 90%. The men and women who complete an apprenticeship program have an average starting salary of more than $50,000 a year. And this is where we see the long-term benefits of the program. On average, the men and women who complete an apprenticeship earn $300,000 more over their lifetime than someone who didn't have the benefit of an apprenticeship program.
Gillibrand's figures are bolstered by a Department of Labor study that found workers who complete apprenticeships earn an average of $240,000 more in wages over a lifetime than job seekers with similar work experience. Stark credits the Cuomo administration with helping the manufacturing resurgence in New York.
That's good for the economy. It's good for union jobs. It's good for non-union jobs. It's good for workers. And that's what we need, is good paying manufacturing jobs, because that was always the base of America. Not sector jobs, service jobs, but manufacturing was our base in America. And that's what made America great, our great manufacturing sector.
The measure would also allow veterans in apprenticeships to receive credit for previous military training and experience, as well as incentivize the mentoring of apprentices by senior employees.
And that report from the best of our knowledge is Dave Lucas. Finding new job training methods is good. Discovering new ways to understand what your brain is doing, well, that's kind of cool. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We've all heard that the eyes are the window to the soul, but are they also the window to the brain? I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Llewellyn Padiachi, professor of neuroscience at the University of Cape Town, is looking for a new way to examine this key part of our anatomy.
Probably the greatest goal in the modern era is a better understanding of the complexity that is peculiar to the human brain. While most brain monitoring techniques are invasive, time-consuming, and require extensive infrastructure, we have explored the potential of using ultrasound as a completely non-invasive, relatively inexpensive, ubiquitous brain monitoring tool. This modality, which uses sound waves reflected by the substance of the brain, is most beneficial when applied to children with neurological disease. In a resource-limited setting such as sub-Saharan Africa, we could spare these children the unnecessary exposure to harmful radiation, anesthesia, and surgery. Our study has demonstrated benefit in accurately assessing the pressure in the brain and the related blood flow dynamics of the eye. By merely placing a small probe over the eyeball, we are able to use this natural window to access information about the brain. As a result of our committed use of this modality, we have subsequently developed a novel dynamic technique at the Red Cross War Memorial Children's Hospital that has significantly improved accuracy while potentially decreasing the cost and complexity of historically used techniques. We have analyzed data from over 200 neurosurgical patients and have demonstrated the benefit of the current technique, and most notably have introduced a locally innovative application that has been well received at numerous national and international forums. Our work has resulted in collaborations with centers in other African countries, as well as the leading neuronavigation unit in Europe. The opportunity to take a ubiquitous tool and transform the quality of its application within a neuroscientific community to levels comparable with most advanced centers in first world countries is truly an inspiring prospect.
That was Llewellyn Padiachi of the University of Cape Town. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.